The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com, that is gsuggsinsurance.com, or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated September 4, 2023. Its front cover is bordered in red as usual, with a narrow inner white border, Time, in large block capital letters, is in white, superimposed upon a light sky blue background. In the foreground, there's a depiction of a roller coaster. I don't think it's a real photograph, but some of the caricatures within the within the illustration may be actual photos that have been digitized or photoshopped. It's a tall ride, a tall roller coaster, and there on the top, coming down the incline, there are white clouds in that blue sky behind them. Up at the top corner in the right is our 100th year, printed as if in a page-turning situation. Now, in this roller coaster, which is in red, decorated in abstract flag patterns with red and white stripes and white stars on a blue ground in kind of a V shape. I wonder if that's intentional. In the front car is riding former President Donald Trump. His blonde hair is blowing askew, and he has his mouth open, and it looks like he's yelling, and his hands are in the air making fists, and he has a white shirt and a dark blue suit and a red tie that's blowing over his shoulder. And about two cars back, there's another figure seated, and that's Governor DeSantis of Florida, and he looks glum. His hair's all in position. It's nothing's blowing on him. He's wearing a dark coat and a brighter blue shirt with no tie. Behind him, there are two individuals, a man and a woman. Behind them, in another car, two men, one of whom is former Vice President Pence. Behind them, in another car, there are two individuals, one of whom is recognizable as former governor, I think, Chris Christie, and his hands in the air, too, one hand, one arm, making a fist. And then there are three other people in cars still behind them. So we have Mr. Trump in the front car, and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 in the roller coaster cars behind him. Beginning now from the September 4 edition of Time, The Brief, After the Flames by Carl Vick. In the Maui wildfires, a summer of climate warnings reached a hellish crescendo. Well, summer isn't over yet. This is a full-page photograph in color, another lovely blue sky as on the cover depiction, but in the background a denuded tree. It's just scruffy looking and brown. In front of that, lots of debris. I see metal. I see fencing, mesh from some fencing perhaps. Something that looks like buckets and boxes that would have been metal, perhaps a metal ladder. There are two people combing through this debris. Both are wearing long-sleeved, loose-fitting attire with caps, with face masks. Oh, more pictures already on the second page, and this is another one-and-a-half-page photo spread of four different photos. I will read the captions to you. clockwise from top left, four photos. A woman hoses down a friend's property in Coolaw, August 12, and she looks like she's beat. She's not wearing shoes, but she is wearing long jeans and a long-sleeved shirt. She's leaning against a post of some kind with a hose in her right hand. The next photo is the hillside town of Coolaw, suffered property damage but no deaths. And here is some of the property damage depicted. It's a burned-out car. The vehicle has squished tires, and the metal is all deteriorating and discolored. The interior looks gone. Another photo, people affected by the fires receive free goods from Costco in Kahului. And there's a Costco employee right up front, Brian. I can see that he has his Costco name tag on, with dozens of shoppers lined up behind him with large shopping carts. One woman has Ziploc bags in hers. Let's see, other people have, looks like, cases of bottled water. And I can't see what else. Oh, they have huge bins, huge boxes of pillows that apparently the shoppers are able to choose from. And then finally, the last of the four photos, it's brown on brown, and it's really devastating. It's a bird that lies dead in Lahaina. Okay, on to the text now. Images of smoldering landscapes have been coming out of Hawaii as long as there's been photography. Again, this is After the Flames by Carl Vick. But those pictures are about creation in an archipelago built around volcanoes. Eruptions are additions, not addictions, additions. And when lava brings destruction, it does so slowly. With so much warning, photographers can gather from around the world to document it. Wildfires are different. Lahaina vanished in less than a day. A brush fire that sprang back to life August 8 had, by mid-morning August 9, reduced the historic city of 13,000 to the color of ash. The death toll, which surpassed 100 August 15, marked the wildfires as America's deadliest in more than 100 years. At least 2,200 structures burned. Some people survived by climbing into the sea. By the time they arrived, what awaited news photographers, including David Buteau on assignment for Time, was the human effort to navigate the brutal topography of climate change. The particular skills of the local culture came into play immediately, he recalled. Rescuers and relief supplies were ferried in a range of craft, from large tourist boats to jet skis and traditional Hawaiian canoes. In the summer of 2023, weather reports sounded like klaxons, and the very sky pulsed red with warning. Even in a world with technology that might mitigate future harms, we are confronted again with our powerlessness in the face of humankind's own past actions. So the news from Maui carried a potency beyond the devastating tally of deaths. Much of what makes Hawaii feel like paradise is a culture of harmony, first of all with nature. But the islands have also grown hotter, drier, and subject to extreme weather, like the wind that drove flames down the mountain and people into the sea. There is no escape. Another full-size two-page photo is next. It shows the brownness of the scene, of all the burned-out cars, the burned-up trees, the buildings that are half-standing. No people are seen in this scene of devastation. In the back, though, there are mountains, hills, with some green on them, low-lying clouds, perhaps bringing rain to those mountains. Some blue sky also apparent. The caption reads, Lahaina, August 14, of more than 2,200 structures that burned, most were residential. Turning the page. to a new story. The brief news, politics, why Trump's Georgia case may matter most, by Philip Elliott. The signs in Georgia were there for months. Back in February, the forewoman of a special grand jury hinted that her advisory panel had recommended criminal charges against not a short list of familiar names in connection to an effort to overturn the results of Georgia's 2020 presidential election. The prosecutor asked a county judge in May to keep the courthouse clear and prepared for any potential violence, just in case she moved ahead with a second grand jury seeking an indictment of ex-President Donald Trump. July 27, orange barricades encircled the Fulton County Courthouse compound, telegraphing as clearly as possible that the former leader of the free world was about to face a judicial summons, even as he leads the pack of rivals for the Republican Party's nomination in 2024. August 14, those convinced Trump may have acted illegally in his attempts to set aside his legitimate loss in Georgia in 2020 found they were not alone. The Fulton County District Attorney and a grand jury agree. The indictment they handed down includes 13 state charges of racketeering, soliciting a public official to violate their oath, conspiracies to impersonate a public official, to commit forgery, to falsify writings and statements, and to file false documents. Fulton County D.A. Fannie Willis's indictment brings the number of criminal cases against Trump to 4, after he became the first president to ever be criminally indicted earlier this year. He now faces 91 criminal charges in 4 jurisdictions and will need to juggle numerous trial dates with the packed 2024 primary calendar. Trump has pleaded not guilty or denied wrongdoing in all charges. It has been a busy August, just 2 weeks before Willis, Justice Department Special Counsel Jack Smith, brought felony charges against Trump for similar alleged attempts to subvert the will of the voters in 2020 and his alleged role in fomenting the January 6, 2021 riot at the U.S. Capitol. August 1, Smith charged Trump with a conspiracy to defraud the United States, a conspiracy to obstruct an official proceeding, obstruction of and attempt to obstruct an official proceeding, and a conspiracy against voting rights. The charges are severe and may offer catharsis for those seeking accountability for the violence in D.C. that sent scores of career politicos into therapy for the trauma that comes when a federal office building becomes a war zone. But however historic and powerful the Justice Department's case, the Georgia prosecution appears to be the most formidable. The 98-page indictment describes a state fending off the predations of a president. The sweeping charges allege an organized effort to illegally change the vote count and send fake electors to Washington to make Trump the winner in the state instead of Joe Biden. The alleged conduct in the indictment includes a phone call during which Trump asked Georgia's Secretary of State to find him enough votes to win, harassment of an election worker, an effort to appoint a false slate of electors, and a scheme to access voting machines. Along with Trump, 18 other people will also face charges under Georgia's anti-racketeering law for their alleged roles in the plot, including his former personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, and former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, along with other allies. And the 41-count indictment suggests there are 30 other unindicted co-conspirators. Crucially, Georgia may be the only case that Trump cannot escape with a self-pardon or payment. Presidential pardon power applies only to federal charges, and the other state case in New York does not carry potential jail time. That is why the Georgia case could be the most durable, most threatening, and most important headache facing Trump. As he runs to occupy the Oval Office again, Georgia's indictment may set up a collision course over whether state laws can compel a president to face the music, even if he is busy prosecuting wars, negotiating trade deals, or trying to keep Americans' national security safe. The country has never faced a scenario of determining whether someone in the clink can also have nuclear codes. This is no longer an academic exercise. Voters, including GOP primary voters, will have to consider that remote possibility. In typical fashion, Trump blew off both election interference indictments with personal screeds against prosecutors, dubbing Willis Phony Fanny. Previous indictments have boosted Trump's fundraising, but there are signs of fatigue. Each indictment day has proved less profitable than the one prior, and his rivals for the nomination are growing slightly more bold as they watched the fourth, though almost all of them have publicly attacked the charges. Trump's allies will naturally find a way to brush aside the latest counts, too. The first New York Times Siena College poll of the 2024 cycle, released in late July before the Smith or Willis indictments, indicated Republicans were indifferent to the allegations against Trump regarding election tampering. Among GOP primary voters, 71% said the base should rally behind Trump as he faces investigations. And 71% also do not think Trump has committed serious crimes. But the more cases Trump faces, the more real the potential consequences become. And in Georgia, where courtroom proceedings are routinely televised, reality TV may take on new meaning for the defendant. The Bulletin. China wants to limit children's smartphone use. This is by Chad DeGuzman. Chinese regulators have proposed curbing youth smartphone addiction by requiring device and app makers to have a minor mode that would limit daily usage to at most 2 hours by those 18 and under. China tied for first on a list of 24 countries for problematic cell phone use by youth in a 2022 study. The consequences beyond exasperated parents can be serious, with links to unproductivity, antisocial behavior, higher stress levels, poor sleep quality and mood disorders. Citing the importance of young people to the country's development, President Xi Jinping's government has previously introduced measures to regulate youth tech addiction, like limiting the time children can play video games to 3 hours per week and cracking down on online fandom culture. The new required smartphone setting, minor mode, when enabled, would limit daily use to 40 minutes for those under 8 years old, an hour for those under 16, 2 hours for those under 18. Parents are encouraged to activate it on their children's devices. Exiting the mode would require their approval. Minor mode would also bar access to web forums that discuss fundraising, online polls, and spamming. Features related to emergency services and education programs will not be subjected to limits. The proposal's in a comment period until September 2, but the announcement sent Chinese tech shares tumbling. There are all sorts of businesses which provide services to children online, Ming-Lu Chen, senior lecturer at the University of Sydney, tells Time. So their interest would be hurt massively. Signaling? How effective the ban will be remains to be seen. The proposal by the Cyberspace Administration of China was not clear on enforcement. Penalties for violators were not specified, causing concern among tech companies worried about being held accountable for implementing the new rules. China has a strict real name registration system, which allows it to monitor and regulate internet use. But many children seeking to play video games beyond already imposed limits have found workarounds, from using fake IDs to visiting smartphone arcades. Alfred Wu, associate professor at Singapore's Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy, tells Time the proposal appears to be more of a signal to tech firms and children, rather than a hard and fast rule. It is very much like stepping into an area where the government actually has no control in reality. The brief news, again, good question. Why did early puberty strike during the pandemic? This is by Haley Weiss. Italy noticed first. It was the first country to lock down during COVID-19 pandemic. And later, in 2020, researchers at Florence's Anna Meyer Children's University Hospital were the first to point out a puzzling trend. More young girls than ever before had been showing up at the hospital with clear signs of early onset puberty. The cases were not unique, but their frequency was. Since early onset or precocious puberty first gained widespread clinical attention in the 1990s, it's become steadily more common worldwide. Defined as the appearance of secondary sex characteristics, such as breasts, pubic hair, and vocal changes in girls 8 or younger and boys 9 or younger, precocious puberty has been difficult for researchers to attribute to a single cause, but a mysterious pandemic-generated spike in cases has provided experts with a new opportunity to revisit their dominant theories in hopes of an answer. Case studies have now rolled in from clinics around the world, many of which saw at least a 2- or 3-fold increase in precocious puberty diagnoses after March 2020. In China's Henan province, for example, doctors at 22 facilities saw 5 times as many cases in 2020 as they did in 2018. There is no conclusive answer about what causes premature development, though research shows the constellation of factors at play includes stress and trauma, as well as lifestyle habits like poor diet and lack of exercise that are tied to weight gain in children. Pandemic measures saddled children with this exact package of pressures. Precocious puberty is most often diagnosed in girls because puberty in girls is more visible, says Sena Oersdemoor, a pediatric endocrinologist at Loma Linda University Children's Hospital. Growing breasts is often a public experience, and developing early can mean a minefield of unwanted attention. Then there is the distress of watching their bodies evolve, which can be jarring enough, even for those old enough to have received proper context and education. First and second graders, they're not mature enough to handle this type of body change, says Oersdemoor. That is a big stress for a young girl. Perhaps as a result, early puberty has been linked to mood disorders and some behavioral issues. Precocious puberty can also put children at risk years later for diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and certain reproductive cancers. though some cases are easily traceable to genetic or anomalous causes. Precocious puberty has most often been linked to obesity. Decades of research have found that childhood body weight is a strong predictor of menarche, or the onset of menstruation in particular. Childhood obesity is a growing problem worldwide, which could help explain why precocious puberty has remained on the rise. Still, none of this sufficiently explains the explosion in precocious puberty during COVID-19. The newest wave of research has zeroed in on stress as a key driver. We know from recent data that the psychological burden before and after the pandemic is increasing dramatically, says Mohamed Magni, head of the pediatric clinic at the Giannina Gaslini Institute at the University of Genoa in Italy. When he saw the spike in 2020, he says, "My first thought was focused on lifestyle changes related to social isolation." In his latest study, Magni and his team identify lifestyle changes as contributing factors that many children faced during the pandemic, such as poor eating habits, decreased movement, impaired sleep, and excess screen time. They found that of patients seen during the first 15 months of the pandemic, nearly 90% had stopped all physical activity. Because many of these lifestyle changes are also linked to obesity, it is difficult to tell whether they contributed to the onset of puberty by altering weight, stress levels, or both. It is also possible the pandemic simply meant that parents spotted signs of precocious puberty earlier because of being confined with their children. Researchers are not sure yet whether the increased rate of precocious puberty has continued after lockdown, but anecdotal evidence from clinics suggests it has. Oerstemir believes that this is because people, including children, have not returned to their pre-pandemic habits. This is becoming normal now, she says. The milestones page. Oh, we have two column articles and 2, 4, 5 other categories. One category is continued in a column item. Beginning with lifted, the final COVID-19 restrictions that remained in New Zealand, which instituted some of the world's strictest pandemic rules, including mandatory isolation periods by Prime Minister Chris Hipkins, August 13. Assassinated Ecuadorian presidential candidate Fernando Villavicencio, 59, August 9, while campaigning against government corruption and narco-traffickers who were blamed for his killing. Rebounded, the population of Brazil's endangered golden lion tamarins from around 200 in the 1970s to some 4,800 today, according to an August 1 study that credits conservation efforts. One, that's WON, a landmark climate lawsuit brought by a group of young people against Montana after a judge ruled August 14, it was unconstitutional for the state to disregard climate change when approving fossil fuel projects. Died. Actor Angus Cloud, who played Fezco on HBO's Euphoria, July 31, at 25. Director William Friedkin, whose films included The Exorcist and the Oscar-winning The French Connection, August 7, at 87. Music executive and industry titan Clarence Avant, who spurred the careers of icons including Whitney Houston, Bill Withers, and Janet Jackson, August 13, at 92. Next is a column, Appointed Special Counsel in Biden Probe. This is by Nick Popley. It features a very small headshot in color of Hunter Biden, July 26, wearing a dark blue suit, white shirt, blue tie. He has combed back brown hair with some salt and pepper in it. In July, the legal hardship facing Hunter Biden appeared to be nearing an end. He had reached a plea deal with prosecutors that would keep him out of jail, settled a child support case with the mother of a child he fathered, and started making regular public appearances again with his dad, the president. It seemed as if he would finally turn the page on his troubled past. But it didn't quite work out that way. August 11, Attorney General Merrick Garland appointed a special counsel in his case. David Weiss, the U.S. attorney in Delaware, who negotiated the plea deal, which had fallen apart. Weiss has said he plans to indict Hunter Biden on tax charges, but he could also use his new, wider authority to levy additional charges in the case, like a potential violation of the Foreign Agents Registration Act. Whatever happens will likely be over months, keeping any sins of the son in headlines during the campaign of the father. And in addition to the four deaths already cited, died Paul Reubens, R-E-U-B-E-N-S, forever in character. A photograph, almost half a page in color, accompanies this. It's of a person looking at himself in the mirror. We see only the blurry back shoulder of the person, but the mirror image is clear and sharp. Dark, slick-backed hair, dark eyes, a pouty-looking mouth, and a very soft-looking face, wearing a gray suit, a white shirt, and a pinkish-red bow tie, which the person is tying or straightening. Paul Reubens, best known for his character Pee Wee Herman, died July 30 at 70 after a private battle with cancer. Please accept my apology for not going public with what I've been facing the last 6 years, Reubens wrote in a statement posted to Instagram after his death. I've always felt a huge amount of love and respect from my friends, fans, and supporters. I have loved you all so much and enjoyed making art for you. The character Pee Wee Herman, introduced in a 1978 improv class, first made it big in 1981 with the Pee Wee Herman show. Reubens began to do interviews and tour only as Pee Wee, creating the impression that he was a real person. In 1985, Pee Wee's Big Adventure, directed by Tim Burton, recouped its $7 million budget nearly seven times over. From 1986 to 1991, the live-action children's program Pee Wee's Playhouse was a hit with both kids and parents. Reubens aimed to shape Pee Wee into a positive role model, intentionally imbuing the show with a moral compass. It came as a surprise to many when Reubens was arrested in 1991 on charges of indecent exposure in an adult theater. He denied the charges in a statement, then pleaded no contest. But in the early aughts and 2010s, Pee Wee returned, bringing back the Pee Wee Herman show and releasing the 2016 movie Pee Wee's Big Holiday. By the time of his death, Pee Wee and Reubens had been largely accepted back into the public fold. Outpourings of love and support appeared across social media after his death. "Love you so much, Paul," tweeted the actor, Natasha Lyonne, who got her start on Pee Wee's Playhouse. One in all time, Thank you for my career and your forever friendship and all these years, and for teaching us what a true original is. That column was written by Laura Zornosa. The brief education, back to school, the creative ways teachers are using AI, by Olivia B. Waxman. Peter Pacone, a social studies teacher in San Marino, California, has a new teacher's aide helping him in the classroom this year. He plans to defer to his helper to explain some simpler topics to his class of high schoolers, like the technical aspects of how a cotton gin worked, in order to free up time for him to discuss more analytical concepts, like the effects of the First Industrial Revolution. His new assistant, ChatGPT. What I feel that I don't have to do any longer is cover all the content, Pacone told a group of more than 40 educators in a May Zoom workshop, which he organized. If artificial intelligence is on the cusp of reshaping entire aspects of society, from healthcare to warfare, the realm that leaps first to many minds is education. Asked a question online, ChatGPT will produce an answer that reads like an essay. So students and teachers preparing for a new school year are also grappling with AI's implications for learning, homework, and integrity. Pacone is among many high school teachers already experimenting with ChatGPT in the classroom. But the tool is inspiring as much trepidation as it is excitement. Earlier this year, an OpenAI.com, the website of the company that produced ChatGPT, became one of the 50 most visited websites in the world. Some of the nation's largest school districts, from New York City to Los Angeles, banned its usage in the classroom while they worked to formulate policies around it. Meanwhile, teachers desperate to figure out how to harness the tech for good congregated in Facebook groups like ChatGPT for Teachers, about 300,000 members, and the AI Classroom, more than 20,000 members. The majority of the teachers are panicked because they see ChatGPT as a cheating tool, a tool for kids to plagiarize, says Rankin, a high school principal in Newton Falls outside Youngstown, Ohio. But Pacone and a growing group of educators believe it is too late to keep AI out of their classrooms. Randy Weingarten, president of the American Federation of Teachers, a major teachers' union, believes the panic about AI is not unlike the ones caused by the Internet and graphing calculators when they were first introduced, arguing ChatGPT is to English and to writing like the calculator is to math. In this view, there are two options facing teachers. Show their students how to use ChatGPT in a responsible way, or expect the students to abuse it. As teachers wrestle with whether to use AI in their classrooms this year, they are also learning about the pernicious ways that abuse can take place. At another Zoom teacher training workshop that Time observed in July, hosted by Garnet Valley School District in Garnet Valley, Pennsylvania, education consultant A.J. Giuliani ran through various AI apps that students are using to cut corners in class. PhotoMath lets students upload a picture of a math problem and get detailed instructions on how to solve it. Tome can turn notes into a narrative. And ReadWise can highlight key parts of PDFs so students can get through readings faster. Many of them are just using it to do the work because they're bored, Giuliani says. They are not engaged. They do not care, and we have to own up to that. Many of the more than a dozen teachers Time interviewed for this story argue that the way to get kids to care is to proactively use ChatGPT in the classroom. Some creative ideas are already in effect at Peninsula High School in Gig Harbor, about an hour from Seattle. In Aaron Rossing's pre-calculus class, a student got ChatGPT to generate a rhyme about vectors and trigonometry in the style of Kanye West, while geometry students used the program to write raps about mathematical proofs, which they performed in a classroom competition. In Kara Belote's English language arts class, she allowed students reading Shakespeare's Othello to use ChatGPT to translate lines into modern English to help them understand the text so that they could spend class time discussing the plot and themes. ChatGPT does not always get things right, but teachers are finding that provides its own way to engage students. Some are having students fact-check essays generated by the program, hoping to simultaneously test students' knowledge of the topic and show them the problems with relying on AI to do nuanced work. In the Detroit area, Sarah Millard, a ninth-grade honors English teacher, had students critique a ChatGPT-generated essay on Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet. "My students have never been so engaged in writing," Millard says. "They wanted to beat the computer and were tearing apart the AI-generated essay." Teachers are even finding ChatGPT is a time saver for their own homework. Larry Farlazzo, who teaches English, social studies, and international baccalaureate classes in Sacramento, has had AI help write college recommendation letters for some of his students. He says it did the task 10 times better than he would have done. While many educators seem to agree that an outright ban on ChatGPT in the classroom is not the answer, they differ on how much it will change schools. Some think it will be a revolution. "There is a tidal wave coming for education," says Dan Fitzpatrick, an author and keynote speaker on AI in education and administrator of the AI Classroom Facebook group. "Our schools could really find themselves irrelevant in the next few months to a few years." Others believe it may become a useful tool, but the basics of schooling won't change. "I've lived through probably 9 hype cycles of AI and education, where visionaries proclaim this is the big breakthrough, and then it isn't," says Chris Deedy, a senior research fellow at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, who is an expert on the history of educational technologies. "Generative AI is certainly not, in my opinion, some kind of enormous breakthrough that's going to transform education. There are real concerns about ceding too much instruction to the program. Weingarten of the Teachers Union and others fear it will promote educational inequities, further dividing classrooms into students whose families have the resources to afford the high-speed internet connection that eases access to ChatGPT and students whose families do not. There are also worries about biases in the data AI uses to craft its answers to users' prompts. And it will be no small challenge for teachers to figure out how to use the technology to develop students' critical thinking skills without sacrificing the meaningful connections that can be the product of human-to-human teaching. When it comes to getting knowledge to stick, there may be no substitute for human relationships. I have been to former students' weddings and baby showers and funerals of their parents, says Millard, the high school English teacher in Michigan. "I have hugged my students. I have high-fived my students. I have cried with my students. A computer will never do that." ever, ever. Q&A, the Secretary on Education. This may need to be abbreviated for time constraints, but it's in the question and answer format with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 questions. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And it's written by Olivia B. Waxman. The 2 years that Miguel Cardona has been in the nation's top education job have not exactly been serene. In June, the Supreme Court rejected President Joe Biden's student loan forgiveness plan, and in another ruling, essentially overturned affirmative action. The nation is in the midst of both a teacher shortage and a wave of book banning attempts. At the same time, students are still working to recover from pandemic-era learning loss. The Secretary of Education covered all that, plus ChatGPT, in a July conversation with Time. First question, when the student loan payment pause ends this fall, what do you say to borrowers who will not be able to make ends meet? Answer. We announced the best income-driven repayment program in our country's history, which will change the experience for so many borrowers. It cut in half the college payments that are due to undergraduate students. We are also going to fight really hard to continue with debt relief. The Supreme Court got the decision wrong. Question. With the Supreme Court effectively overturning affirmative action, what practices could build more diverse student bodies at the nation's top colleges and universities? Answer, that's another example where the Supreme Court took us backwards, a really, really wrong decision. It ignores the fact that in this country, as much as we are fighting for an equitable system, it is still not there. We could be talking about health care access, higher education access, K through 12 education outcomes. Black and brown students particularly have to work twice as hard to get to that starting block. Question. The math and reading performance of 13-year-olds in the U.S. hit the lowest level in decades per test scores from the National Assessment of Educational Progress, NAEP, what needs to be done? Answer, it is appalling how the nation's report card continues to remind us not only of how poorly our students are performing, but also of the impact of a pandemic. There is a plan for bringing qualified teachers into classrooms because we can talk about reading and math all we want, but we have a teacher shortage. If we are not hiring highly qualified teachers, it is going to be difficult to get those numbers up. Question, how can learning loss caused by the COVID-19 pandemic be reversed? Answer, this administration put out $130 billion to address the impact of the pandemic. What we have seen is the dollars being used to provide after-school tutoring support for students, summer school programming. More students attended summer school in the past several years than ever in the history of our country. We have seen the money being used to provide reading teachers in classrooms for students that are falling behind, to provide laptops and level the playing field, to provide support for professional development for teachers who are now supporting students that have faced some trauma. Maybe their students lost someone during the pandemic, or are dealing with some anxiety because of the pandemic. The NAEP data are a sobering reminder of the work we have to do, but we are seeing progress. Question. The American Library Association reported that efforts to ban books nearly doubled from 2021 to 2022. What can the Department of Education do to help school districts facing book banning attempts in the next year? Answer. Book banning is an example of the folks who have political aspirations, trying to keep their name on the national radar, very selfishly at the expense of our students. Parents do not want anyone in the state capitol telling them which books they should have. It is a direct attempt to censor what our students are reading and ignoring our country's history. Attempts are targeting primarily books on the history of the black and brown experience, students who are marginalized, books that represent the diversity of our country. We need to call it what it is, attempts to further marginalize a marginalized group. Question, do you think teachers should use ChatGPT with students? Answer, let's face it, our students are going to be using it. It is important that we help them use it responsibly. We need to do a better job providing our teachers with professional learning opportunities to learn it themselves. With artificial intelligence, we have the opportunity to move past some of the rote memorization and really think about problem solving and analysis and deeper levels of thinking and learning. And the final question, what would you tell young educators who are thinking about leaving the profession because of burnout? Answer, burnout is real. I get it. But this is a time when our students and our country need you most. On average, teachers make 27% less than other peers with similar degrees. That is unacceptable. I am calling on states to step up education funding and make sure educators are being paid competitively. But to that young person who wants to become a teacher, you have an administration in office right now that is fighting hard for you and that is supporting you. There's a photo here. It's not very large, but it's colorful, and the room is crowded. The room is crowded. Miguel Cardona, the Secretary of Education, is kneeling on the floor. He's dressed up. He's in a dark blue suit and a white shirt and a red tie. His hairline is receding. It's brownish, and it looks like he may have a lot of white facial hair there. He's wearing glasses, and he's speaking to some kids because he is surrounded by them. There are little tables everywhere with little children seated at all the little tables everywhere. There are adults in the room, more adults than I've ever seen in an elementary school classroom. I'm guessing they're principals and teachers' assistants and maybe some of the PTA. I don't know. They're not labeled. The diversity of the group, in what I can see, appears to be a lot of cute girls with all kinds of fancy hairdos. They are a diverse group ethnically. I see dark-skinned children and lighter-skinned children, and the teachers are likewise, the teachers and other adults in the room are likewise. The caption reads, Cardona visits Avondale Elementary School in Columbus, Ohio, April 20, and it looks like he's having a good time. I would think he would be. Oh, the kids. I can't tell you their ages. From my experience, I'm guessing they could be as young as kindergarten and probably not older than first grade. So they're on the cusp of going from kindergarten into first grade, because that's a big deal. There isn't time to read another article, but I'm going to give you a preview of what you might hear next week from The View, The Parent Trap. This is about American teens. Climate and health, those are small essay-type columns. The Day Hip-Hop Changed Forever is in the music genre. Politics, Deja Vu. Oh, goodness, it talks about the GOP primary and Iowa. This is going to be a long article because it features a lot of people. Changing Clothes, Time 100 Leadership Series. This is going to be about the fashion industry, even including a runway modeling gig here in Paris in March, but it looks like these people are walking on fine sawdust. These are all models, you know, tall, thin models, with a whole group of people watching them from the bleachers of a big stadium space. And beside the models are lined up these beautiful white horses that look like the Lipizzaners. But it very, very specifically says it's the Stella McCartney Women's Wear Winter 2023 show in Paris in March. Lots of brown and black and red in that lineup. Then this Healing Sea about the South Pacific. You're basically getting the same preview of this magazine that I am. Baja in the Balance. That's going to be about the fishing industry around Baja, California. Lots of photos of fish here. Lots of different kinds of fish. Then with Time Off, The New Romantics by Judy Berman, who writes some reviews, or maybe critiques, or maybe both. With Judy, it's usually comprehensive, regardless. Then we're almost at the end. Here's some reviews by Stephanie Zakarik of movies, The Man Who Was Everything, and Then Some. It's Lisa Cortez, Little Richard, I Am Everything. Okay, then an essay, Writing for Friends Was No Joke. Then some ads, and then 8 questions. Let's see if there really are 8 here. There really are 8. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.